Revenue Committee is called to order. Good morning, everyone. Today we are going to look at the reports from the tax expenditure and tax credits that we do every session. And it's a good subject this time as the Tax Credit Committee gets ready to come forward and are continuing sunsetting of this of these bills. So let's see where we are here first. And Paul, with that, I will turn it over to you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Always a favorite every session, the tax expenditure report. And legislature in 1995 directed Department of Revenue to issue a report every 2 years, comes out same time as the governor's budget. I think it's just about as thick, and we do have some hard copies. At the Department of Revenue, the Revenue Research Section has done the work on this and has put a lot of time and effort into it and has come and briefed you on it each session. So here today is Craig Fishers, the manager of the Research Section, and John Hart, two of the primary authors of the report.
Gentlemen.
And they have the reports, I can see.
Good morning, Chair Haas and members of the committee. My name is Craig Fisher. I'm the research manager at the Department of Revenue. And joining me today is John Hart, who is a senior economist with our department. As Paul mentioned, we'd like to provide you today with an overview of the tax expenditure report. It's a fairly imposing document, and so what we hope to do is give you some context for the report and perhaps give you some ways that you can use the information in the report easily. So what we'd like to do today is John's going to start with providing some conceptual framework, a background about the concept of tax expenditures generally, and also how it applies to Oregon specifically, and also provide you with some ways to look at various components of tax expenditures. One useful thing is to break these up into sort of usable sections, I think, and he's going to help us do that. And then I'll step through some of the requirements of the report and give you some tips and some observations that we have that hopefully will make this a useful document for you.
Are you going to hand out some of these afterwards, or?
We have some.
Yeah.
Or do you want us to not do that so we'll pay attention to what you're saying?
Well, Mr. Chair, you're welcome to review them as we talk.
Okay. Go ahead.
Mm-hmm. We're going to go page by page. Right?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, it's a pleasure to be here this morning. I'm John Hart, a senior economist with the Department of Revenue, and we're going to talk briefly about what's an extremely complicated issue. We package it nicely, and it doesn't always look as complicated as it is, but we'll talk about some of the nuances of the report as we go through. Tax expenditures as a concept really came to the forefront in the late 60s at the federal level. The Treasury Department published the first tax expenditure budget at the federal level in 1967 or 8. And in 1995, Oregon passed a law requiring a tax expenditure report as well. The first tax expenditure report in Oregon actually came from the Legislative Revenue Office. They did a compilation, and the Budget Accountability Act in 1995 for Oregon required our more comprehensive report. The general idea of tax expenditures is that a lot of tax programs look like direct expenditures. And so, for instance, if you want to help somebody with childcare, you can give them a 20% credit against the cost of their childcare, or you can write them a check for 20% of the cost of their child care. And those two things have kind of similar budgetary impacts, but they're accomplished through different mechanisms. The Budget Accountability Act mentions that tax expenditures are similar to direct expenditures and says that the tax expenditure report allows the review of tax expenditures in conjunction with online budgets and other expenditures. The Act in 1995 gave a very particular definition for tax expenditures. This definition is different than what's used in other states and by the federal government. It has some similarities as well. I'll go ahead and read it and try to highlight the important parts here. A tax expenditure in Oregon is any law of the federal government or of this state that exempts in whole or in part certain persons' income, goods, services, or property from the impact of established taxes, including but not limited to tax deductions, tax exclusions, tax subtractions, tax exemptions, tax deferrals, preferential tax rates, and tax credits. One of the important points in that definition is that the tax expenditure is an exemption from the impact of established taxes. And so other states and the federal government tend to define tax expenditures as deviations from a reference tax or a normal tax as they define it, and ours is specifically a deviation from established taxes. The other categories there, the exemptions, or the exclusions, deductions, subtractions, and credits are referenced specifically in our income tax chapter. Our book is divided into 15 chapters by tax program. The first two chapters, income and property, are 336 of the 372 total listed tax expenditures. The income chapter is sorted first by the type of tax expenditure. So the first things listed are federal exclusions. The second things listed are adjustments and deductions. And then within each of those categories, they're also sorted by budget program. Our report says to be careful when adding up the revenue losses or the revenue impacts that are associated with each of the tax expenditures and coming to a total. And right after it says to be careful in doing that, we provide a table that does that. It should be taken a little bit with a grain of salt. But one way people like to look at the scope and magnitude of tax expenditures is to look at the number of tax expenditures and also to look at the total revenue impact or revenue loss that was estimated for the tax expenditures. And I would emphasize that that all of these are estimates in one way or another. Federal exclusions, for instance, are things that we generally don't have perfect data about. We have kind of corollary data. We have better data about deductions, subtractions, and credits, and pretty good data on some of the property tax things. But they are all, to one extent or another, estimates. Here we have a list of the top 10 income tax expenditures. The other table showed that we had 204 total income tax expenditures, but these top 10 represent 60% of the value. The three that are shaded in blue are the ones that are Oregon law. The other ones are federal law. But it's worth seeing that 60% of the value is in 10 of 204 tax expenditures. On the property tax side.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you elucidate a little bit on the number one, which is employer-paid medical benefits? And the reason I talk about that is, you know, I'm slightly biased. My staff, who has, you know, public health care, is beating me up because, you know, they're going to be in the Cadillac tax category here at the federal side under the Affordable Care Act here shortly. And the employer-paid medical benefits, you know, that's 10% of the total. Have you guys looked at how is that going to, in you know, 1 year, 2 year, 4 years, 6 years out as the Affordable Care Act kind of goes in, some of that is going to become taxable in the Cadillac tax and at the federal level, which, of course, my interest is not so much at the federal level because we ain't fixing Washington, D.C., but at the state level, that has an impact on what is deductible, not deductible, and how that rate right there moves. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, Senator Boquist, the details of that one in particular aren't at the tip of my tongue, but I can tell you how we look at federal tax expenditures generally. And what we do with most of those is we look at the estimates at the federal level, and we use mechanisms to decide how much of the federal exclusion applies in Oregon, and then we convert that exclusion to a tax in Oregon. So to the extent that the federal estimates are taking that into account, and they're done by the Joint Committee on Taxation for the U.S. Congress, and they are also done under current law, those things are taken into account in our expenditure report as well. The Joint Committee on Taxation, I think, has estimates out a little bit past the scope of our report. So if you want further information, I can send you what they have, or I can send it to your staff to pass along.
I think it might be helpful for you to give us at least a one-sentence explanation of those top 10, what they do, who gets it, where it came from.
Okay, Mr. Chair. So the employer-paid medical benefits are an exclusion. If your employer pays for your medical benefits, it's not counted as income for withholding or for taxes. Pension contributions and earnings, there's really two pieces there. If you or your employer are contributing to a pension plan, that contribution is not initially counted in income, and then any earnings on those on prior contributions or the balance of the account are not included in income. Oregon's personal exemption credit is kind of an analog to the deduction that's given at the federal level. Oregon uses a credit, and at the federal level there's a deduction, and it's generally for each person or dependent on a tax return. Home mortgage interest is interest paid. Really, it's all of the deductions are above the standard deduction. So if all of your deductions exceed the standard deduction, the amount they exceed the standard deduction is excluded from taxation. And home mortgage interest on, I think, up to two homes and up to $10 million, not $10 million, $1 million in mortgage is excluded. The interest on that is. Oregon has a federal income tax subtraction, so an amount that's adjusted by inflation every year is subtracted from taxable income before figuring Oregon income.
But that's limited, right?
It is limited. There's a
that was a result of a ballot measure 10, 15 years ago.
Well, there was a measure that there was action taken by the legislature in 02 that limited the ballot measure, phased it in. But the major income limit now is part of Measure 66.
The next two are Social Security benefits. There's a federal exclusion for Social Security benefits that's relatively complicated. The Oregon Constitution says that Oregon will not tax Social Security benefits. So those two together represent all Social Security benefits received by Oregon taxpayers. Property taxes paid by Oregon taxpayers can be deducted. The ninth one on the list there, the income of controlled foreign corporations, is the income held by a controlled corporation overseas that hasn't been repatriated. There's usually a lot of controversy about that one, and
you can give an explanation on that one a little bit and how it relates, if it does, to tax havens legislation that we're considering.
Yes, Chair Hass, the relationship with tax havens is a bit complicated. You hear tax shelters with respect to tax havens, and if you hold your income in a place like Ireland, you get names for tax shelters like Dutch Irish sandwich. I don't know. There's some complicated maneuvers that are used that have been in the news. This is related to those, but something like an inversion is only a very small part of this estimate. And this, again, is an estimate that's made at the federal level, and then we try to figure out what the Oregon share of that is. So it's a pretty rough estimate.
So we're sort of piggybacking on to the federal law, and a lot of these, but on this one, do. There would be no reason we couldn't eliminate that, the state part of that.
Chair Hess, the connection to the federal income is how Oregon gets that. I believe it would only be statute could repeal that and disconnect.
Senator.
You said repeal the and disconnect, but we have additions and subtractions which could occur without disconnecting.
Mr. Chair, Senator Riley, some of the additions that we have are due to disconnecting. So the statute for a lot of our additions says that anything excluded under a certain Internal Revenue Code section will be added back to Oregon taxable income, and that's actually where we get some additions. And so we have a few, and there's things that are different some years and not others, like qualified production activities at the federal level we are not connected to, and some of the more difficult depreciation issues.
Thank you.
I don't want to tell war stories, but when we disconnected from QPI a decade ago, it saved the state millions of dollars and a lot of litigation.
Mm-hmm.
So I just, you know, superficially, when I see the top 10 here, see some opportunities to perhaps disconnect and do something else that may be more advantageous to our economy or to our educational system. So just food for thought.
Mr. Chair, just to kind of as a preview for next Monday, we do have a report from the Department of Revenue, their corporate section, who has been administering the legislation you passed in 13 on the tax havens. So we'll get an update from them. We don't have any data yet that's come in, but they'll explain how they've implemented the legislation that you enacted. It does represent an area where our policy has been, the state's policy has been to connect at the water's edge, meaning we use a federal definition of so-called water's edge income. The tax haven legislation is an exception to that. It goes out beyond that, so it is a broadening of what's potentially taxable.
Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Before we go on, I just wanted to ask the question about Social Security benefits. Would that also include Social Security disability benefits? They're not taxable? Is that...
Mr. Chair, Senator, I believe that is the case. I believe the Oregon Constitution doesn't distinguish the between Social Security retirement and Social Security disability.
Sure. Just a question for Mr. Warner in the future, not today, because I mean the direct correlation is we go into the Cadillac tax, which like looking across the room, every public employee, including us, so I guess we have a conflict of interest. This employer-paid medical benefits and how that changes under the Affordable Care Act, which I'm not even debating that issue, and how that then correlates with the federal income tax subtraction, because we're going to be taxed extra for having Cadillac policies, which is virtually every public employee that has health care in the entire state, city, county, all the way across the board, versus the federal income tax subtraction, that's going to have an impact on our revenue generation at the state level, let alone our personal, how we all might personally feel about this. And it'd be sometime in the future to have an idea of what that's going to look. And the reason I raise that, Mr. Chairman, is we're probably going to have to tamper with that and how it impacts our state revenue. And when you go down the list, when you go to tampering, it's a good opportunity to level, just as a general statement.
Well, yeah, and it plays into this question we've been asking now for a long time. If we became a new state yesterday after being a territory and we had to write up a new tax code today, would we, for example, connect to all of these things? If we sat down with a clean slate, would our top 10 expenditures look like that? And maybe it would, but maybe it wouldn't.
Precisely, Mr. Chair. And you know, it's easier, and we've had these discussions, so I'll just say it publicly and think throw stones later. I mean, if you have a sunset on something and it's going away, and unfortunately, politically speaking, it's easier just to close your eyes and let it sunset. Some of these issues here are interplaying between what you might have sunsets on in the gray and what we might have a positive or negative impact from what the federal government's going to do in the connection to the federal tax owner. And I think we've had this discussion. I mean, the uncertainty of the depreciation schedule on Section 179 is a prime example. When the feds make the decision on on November 15th, we're going to have Section 179, it doesn't help people like in the forestry sector or in my former sector, because it's too late to have done it. So would it not be better to have a depreciation schedule at the state side in the interplay of these sorts of things here as we go forward?
Sorry to go off on you there.
Mr. Chair, we appreciate the discussions. And it's a complicated topic, and so discussions are, I think, inevitable. I did not yet get to the charitable contributions description. We actually break charitable contributions into three components. We have, I think they're education, health, and other. And so this other category is going to be things like food banks and churches primarily, and any other miscellaneous things that don't fall into the first two categories. So here, our next page, we have the top 10 property tax expenditures. And of 132 property tax expenditures, these top 10 represent 97% of the revenue loss. The very first one, intangible personal property, which is primarily people's financial assets, represents 59% of the total revenue loss from property tax expenditures. Second one is state and local property. So the building we're in now is exempt from property tax. Federal property, which includes in Oregon a lot of forest land and any other federal property is exempt, is the third one. Personal property for personal use, so people's TVs and couches are exempt from property tax. Personal property for business use is not always exempt. Inventory of businesses meant for sale is exempt as well. Motor vehicles and trailers are exempt from property tax, but they do pay other taxes. The strategic investment program, in which counties enter agreements with, I think, very large investment projects, comes along with a property tax exemption, although there are some in-lieu payments associated with that. Private standing timber in western counties is the next one, is exempt from local property tax. And those, again, also pay things like harvest taxes when they're harvested. Farmland gets a special assessment. It's not fully exempt from tax, but it's assessed on a special method. And charitable literary and scientific organizations, so charities, schools, and the like, are exempt, and that rounds out our top 10. But you can see the value of those declines pretty rapidly. The intangible personal property itself, you might be able to make an argument that it was never intended to be included in the tax base, so its inclusion as a tax expenditure is based on a particular statute that says this property is not taxed. And so we see that right now as a deviation from established taxes.
Yesterday and the day before, we've been discussing intangibles in terms of central assessment, which are not measured and not treated as intangibles and treated as a whole, which, of course, makes an interesting policy discussion for all of us here trying to figure out you know, how do we at least create, if not revenue neutral scrutiny, where we go? And then the number one list you have here on the 10 property tax expenditures is quite measurable at $15,360,000,000 as intangible personal property. Could you expand just slightly on how did you come to the $15 million and what do you include in there, you know, that is personal property that's intangible?
Mr. Chair, Senator, that particular estimate is very difficult.
But you have it, so therefore you've got it somehow.
We have included those things which we can include as an estimate, and the primary source of value, maybe even the sole source of value in this estimate, is a measurement of financial assets in the United States, and our guess as to how much of those financial, our educated guess as to how much of those assets are held by Oregonians. And so it is primarily bank accounts and that type of thing is making up the $15 million in the tax expenditure value here. The intangibles involved with central assessment are not included in this estimate.
I got it. Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Senator Boquist.
Okay, so it's what you're saying here in the intangible. I'm trying to wrap my hands around this because we've been at this since 2005. In your thinking or whatever, that most of this $15 billion of intangible personal property is tangible bank accounts that, I don't know, maybe you and I hold in some other state or something like that. We don't have any of that money, but is that what you're saying? Or are we talking more of the intangibles about, like, you know, personal goodwill, so on and so forth like that? I don't have much of that either, by the way. I think you're out too, right?
Mr. Chair, Senator, we don't have good numbers on the personal goodwill or the value of business processes held by Oregonians or the other very specific items that are listed as intangible property in the statutes. We don't have good numbers on those. We do have good numbers at the national level on bank account values and financial assets. And so that's the basis of the estimate here, but this is a ballpark estimate at best. And if the statute were repealed, it would be a big number. It may be twice that number, it may be half that number, but it would be a big number that would be the revenue impact.
Oh, Mr. Chair, I don't think I want to touch that one, because if that one was repealed, I think we'd be in revolt.
Start taxing your cash as property.
Right, you and I wouldn't last a day.
Okay. So one way to think about tax expenditures that we've listed is in categories of those that are more like direct spending and those that are less like direct spending. In the more like direct spending categories, we have those things that are economic incentives to encourage certain activities. We have economic development property tax exemptions. We have a subtraction if you put money in a education savings account. Those things are incentives, and those things are much more like direct spending. We also have financial assistance for certain taxpayers, the earned income credit, the working family child care credit. Those are also much more like direct spending. And it's worth noting that as credits are refundable, or if you can sell a credit to another party, or if the credit is obtained through an auction, those things have a much more similarity to direct spending than other types of tax expenditures. Less like direct spending are provisions that are aimed at simplifying compliance or tax administration. The example that I used last time was we have a specific exemption of tax if you bring in a carton of cigarettes, less one cigarette. So if you buy a carton in another state, smoke a cigarette, and then bring in the 199 cigarettes, we have an exemption of tax for that. Any larger quantity brought in by a consumer is theoretically taxable. We also have a lot of tax expenditures that are the result of federal prohibitions on tax. The federal a federal employee on federal business is exempt from paying the lodging tax, and federal property in the state is exempt from Oregon's property tax.
Federalists are going to break us.
Mr. Chair, John did an excellent job on the fly of giving descriptions of these top 10 in both property tax and income tax. But if you'd like, and the more detailed descriptions are included in the book, if it would be useful to you, we can package those descriptions for the top 10 in each of those and send them to you if you'd like.
That would be great. And we'll be taking these up again more carefully, I think, in the Tax Credits Committee, and maybe even spend an entire hearing on the top 10.
And Mr. Chair, I would follow that. In any additional information they might be able to have on the correlation between, and I keep going back to this because it's going to hit the state, is the employer-paid medical benefits is going to change under the federal tax code, and we know there are certain, they don't suspend it, they're going to change, and I think they're going to have a direct impact on us, because unless in our state-level federal income tax section, the feds are going to tax it, take the money, and we're not going to see any benefit, and we're going to see a loss of revenue. The question is, I don't know whether that's good, bad, or indifferent, but it's going to be problematic, and we're going to have to face that fact.
Mr. Chair, Vice Chair Boquist, we'd be happy to work with Paul and his staff on providing you with some background information.
Just don't call it the senior medical tax credit.
I'd like to step through, if I could, just some of the information that's required by the report and give you some observation and maybe some insight into how these elements may make the book useful to you. So there are certain elements that are required to be included in the book. The first is the statutory authority, pretty straightforward. We also include all of the federal code that are related to all of our federal connects as well, and we provide, even at the federal level, what sunset dates exist for those. The report is required to include a purpose statement, which is a somewhat a nebulous concept. There are some provisions that have explicit statutory language that describe what the purpose of the tax expenditure is. In some cases, these provisions simply exist in law. And even in those cases where there is an explicit purpose statement, it can sometimes be very general, that it's to provide an incentive or it's sort of a general statement. So it's because so few of these have explicit purpose statements, as I'll describe later, it's also necessary that these be evaluated according to whether they accomplish their purpose. So the difficulty in actually identifying what the purpose of each particular provision is makes those evaluations problematic in some cases. Another required element is revenue loss estimates for the provisions. And I'll give you just a couple of observations about the revenue loss estimates that are in the book. The estimates that are in the book are different. We provide estimates for the current biennium and the next biennium. So you'll see 13-15 estimates as well as 15-17 estimates in there. But these will be different than the potential revenue yield from eliminating these provisions. And that's for a couple of reasons. Each of these is estimated independently, and there are interactions between various tax expenditures. So for example, if you eliminated a subtraction, that may raise some taxpayers' taxable income, which would yield additional revenue, but there may be offsetting unused credits, for example, that wouldn't have been used previously but can now be used. So the entire amount of that revenue yield from the change subtraction may not be realizable. There's also a number of provisions that can be taken over time or have carry forwards, and that is if the tax credit, for example, can't be used to offset liability in a particular period, it can be carried forward to another year, sometimes 5 or even 8 years in the future. So eliminating if it's not done retroactively, eliminating a provision may not necessarily yield immediately the revenue loss. So one example of that is the business energy tax credit was sunset in 2012, for example, and I think the 15-17 estimate for that is still around $150 million of revenue loss. So that's a tax expenditure that is actually sunset, and there's still revenue effect from that. Another item for you to be aware of relates to the loss and shift components on our property tax estimates. For when property is exempt, That represents a loss to the local taxing districts that would impose that tax on that property. But there's also, there are cases where there are fixed dollar bonds that need to be repaid, and so they'll be paid by the remaining owners of property. So that's, that burden is essentially shifted from the owners of the tax-exempt property to the remaining property owners within the district. So each property tax revenue loss represents the loss component, which is, again, the loss to the district, and this shift component. So you can view it as the loss to the taxing district, and the loss plus shift is actually the benefit to the owner of the exempt property. So when you see those estimates in there as loss shift, that's sort of the context for those. And then finally, the revenue estimates are based on current law, both Oregon and federal, and is also current economic conditions. So over time, there'll be some, I guess their currency will degrade a bit. And just a very specific example of that is there's a federal subtraction. There are a number of extenders. You may have heard about the extenders in the basic facts or in the orientation that are federal provisions that are regularly renewed for a year or for a short period of time. At the time of the publication of this book, those extenders were scheduled to expire, and so the book reflects that expiration. So the book reflects law, Oregon and federal law, at the time of publication. So, for example, there's a subtraction for teacher expenses, for example, classroom expenses. That was one of those extenders that was scheduled to expire at the time of our publication, so you'll see a 15-17 revenue loss of zero in that case. But that was extended in December after the publication. So there may be, as time goes on, there may be some differences between the law represented in the publication and current law.
One question, on the back to evaluations. To what extent is that a requirement? Because when I go through this book here, which I shouldn't be doing, I should be paying closer attention to it. It says evaluation, not evaluated. So some of these aren't done. So how's that square?
Mr. Chair, there are a number of these that we have not evaluated, including, for example, the federal connections. And one of the motivations for that is it's not entirely clear what the purpose of the federal connections is. Like, one could argue that the reason we connect to the federal definition of taxable income is for the taxpayers to have a consistent treatment between federal and Oregon. So if that's the purpose, then the evaluation is it meets that purpose because it provides Oregonians with a similar view of taxable income. Alternatively, you could view each of those components. I believe there are 100 and some exclusions and adjustments on the federal level. And it's unclear whether the purpose for the mortgage interest deduction, for example, is to promote housing or is it for that consistency of tax treatment. So that's one of the reasons that the federal tax connections aren't evaluated. We also don't evaluate the very small. We don't evaluate expired expenditures because there are a number of these. I mentioned the business energy credit, which continues to have a revenue impact. It's still a tax expenditure, but the evaluation doesn't seem to make sense there since that one is evaluated, since that is sunset. And we also don't evaluate expenditures under $100,000, very small, tiny expenditures. So those are the reasons that we don't do those.
Okay. Thank you.
The fourth required piece of information in the book is that they are to be organized according to budget program or function. And what we have done is we've used in the governor's recommended budget, there are six primary program areas: education, human services, economic and community development, natural resources, consumer and business services, and transportation. And so we've tried to associate each of these provisions. There are about 372 of them with those program areas. In some cases, they don't fit neatly into those particular categories. For example, there are a number of provisions that are prohibited by federal law. It doesn't really, those we don't think fit any of those six sort of spending categories. So we've developed four additional categories with which we place these that don't fit nicely into the program areas. And last publication, we started a process to refine this subject matter distinction a little bit further, and I hope this will be useful to you. And I can show you, this is a little bit of a work in progress, but this will be on our webpage. This isn't in the published book. But we've attempted to designate all of the 372 tax expenditures into these categories, which I think breaks them down into a little bit more bite-sized chunks. For example, you can go to the book and you can see all of the natural resource tax expenditures, but here you can break those, you can see the agriculture and forest and energy and some of the components broken down in a little bit better detail. And because this is so voluminous, we think any way that you can find to sort of break these down into a little bit easier to follow groupings, we think it would be easier. So you can go to the web.
Excuse me. Senator.
Just terminology here. Income maintenance. What is the definition of income maintenance?
If I could, can I go to our, can I actually go to our webpage and we have a set of definitions up there and then I can show you the components that are
yeah.
there. If you don't mind. Work.
Is that what it is?
No.
If you know the answer, just tell me.
Work. Well, here's the, let me go first to the actual subject area. So when you go to our web page, you can step through these. And so I will show you the income maintenance pieces here. And you'll notice they're a mixture of income tax, property tax, all of the 15 tax programs that are in here. And as I said, this is a work in progress. We've designated these. We've taken a shot at categories. But so under income maintenance, we would include public assistance benefits, for example, which is a federal exclusion. Temporary assistance to needy families is not taxed at the federal level. We also define that in Oregon, so we've placed that in the income maintenance category.
Government.
Foster care payments.
So in simple term, government assistance programs.
And public assistance, yes. And then there's a variety of Mr. Chair, we've
good or bad.
You can spend a considerable amount of time identifying where these might fit. Some actually fit more than one category. So there may be, for example, the CHAMPUS TRICARE military medical provision could fall under the health category as well as the military category that we have here. So anyway, these are the components. These are the, you see the exclusions, you see subtractions. We've got the additional deduction for elderly or blind. We've got mobile home tenant payment if there's a mobile home closure. I'm sorry, this is there's a credit for a mobile home closure. The owner of the park makes a payment to, there's a credit provided for that. So those are there are no property tax provisions under income maintenance. They're all these exclusions, subtractions, and credits that we've identified as that category. It's just a way of sort of segmenting them from some of the other categories.
And I see most of that is the personal exemption.
Yes.
So by the way, these if you're listening on OLIS, these have hyperlink connections to this book, things you're speaking.
And here's the we've just added a brief description. As I said, this is a little bit of a work in progress. As we observe this book, we're trying to find ways to make the material in it a little bit more accessible, and we think this is one direction to go. But it's not a trivial thing to try to identify these. So what we've tried to do is place a couple sentences in here. So here's our income maintenance. Includes tax expenditures related to payments intended to assist or compensate certain taxpayers. And this is also back to John's description earlier about the nature of tax expenditures. These aren't all similar types of expenditures. Some are in place to provide incentive for some behavior, some are assistance, and some are, again, prohibited by federal law. There's a lot of different categories of tax expenditures, and it's, I believe it's useful if you sort of can look at it in a variety of different ways.
Thank you.
You're welcome. The report also requires a description of who benefits, and we do that where we can. for those income tax provisions where we have tax return data, we provide quite a bit of detailed information about the number of recipients. We provide a distribution by level of income of how many claimants there are and average amount claimed. So I think you'll find that useful if you go through a lot of the credits where we can. I mean, some of these are claimed by such a small number that we can't provide some of that information and protect the confidentiality of the taxpayers. But you'll see on a lot of the credits and Oregon subtractions that there is this detailed distributional chart that provides some information about the recipients of the programs. As I mentioned, these evaluation is required. There are two elements of the evaluation. They're to be evaluated according to whether they achieve their purpose and whether or not they're the most fiscally effective means of accomplishing their purpose. So this is a very difficult challenge, and I think to some extent this is one of the things that Oregon's tax expenditure report and its treatment generally of tax expenditures is considered, I mean, the state has been considered a leader, both with when the report started and with the establishment of the transparency information, as well as the credits review that's been put in place. So this is, I think, one of the reasons very few states or the federal government actually attempt to produce evaluations of these expenditures, but it's quite a challenge. And the way these are conducted is we work with about 28 state agencies. We identify which agency has either subject matter expertise or program responsibility for the tax expenditures, and work with them to assist them in any way we can to produce an evaluation along these two lines. And you'll see in the narrative or in the discussion of each one of these provisions in the book, the particular agency is attributed. You can identify who has conducted the evaluation. And then the final required report is that the governor provides a recommendation regarding whether the provisions that are sunsetting should be extended or whether the sunset should be allowed to occur.
Can I follow up on that? Just as a curiosity, if you don't know the answer, just say you don't know the answer, right? Especially given the news reports these days. But how many recommendations are there to allow to sunset in this year's report? I mean, two years ago, we did a pretty thorough review of this for a long time. And, I mean, I was just telling Senator Edwards earlier that when we had like 31 of these things that went onto the table that we said, okay, these can go away. And, of course, who benefits became, you know, your written statement of who benefits became one of the hottest topics in those meetings. But then I'm just curious of, I mean, there were a few I remember two years ago when we did this, that were just, you know, the people didn't even exist. I mean, whoever was benefiting was zero to start with, or it was somebody that was leaving or something like that. And I'm just curious, do you know off the top of your head, are there any major ones that, you know, are kind of expiring that just don't exist out there?
Vice Chair, our next report is expiring tax credits. So Chris will go through each. I believe there's 18 of them, right? Mm-hmm. So there's 18 that are scheduled to sunset in July or January 1 of 16.
Yeah, mine was more of a political question. Than, are there some the governor is in agreement with we got to get rid of? That's my question.
Mr. Chair, Vice Chair Boquist, there are six property tax. If you have the report, it's on page 8 of the report. There's a list of sunsetting. As Paul mentioned, there are 18 credits that are going to sunset. There are a number of other provisions as well. And so there are some property tax expenditures that the governor.
Thanks. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
The credits are recommended to be extended.
So just to, I'll wrap up and describe kind of briefly Department of Revenue's role in producing the tax expenditure report. As Paul mentioned, this really is a companion document to the recommended budget. Our role is to first identify and describe new or modified or deleted tax expenditures. And John broached this a bit, and he talked about the difficulty of the conceptual difficulty of identifying these. There are some challenges to this, and I can provide you with another example. There's a transitory lodging tax that, when it was first put in place, it was broadly defined. It was a tax on hotel, motel stays and such. but it wasn't entirely clear whether it would also apply to, say, hospital stays or shelter stays. And there was some question, some ambiguity about whether that was the case. That was clarified in the subsequent legislation, but it raises the question about how do you look at the established base of the lodging tax? Is the lodging tax for the travel-related lodging, and there are no expenditures related to that, or is the lodging tax on all types of lodging, and then Oregon statute specifically excludes hospital stays and shelters and those kinds of things? So depending on how you look at that kind of conceptual question, you may have no tax expenditures in the lodging tax, or you have the ones that we've listed. So there are a variety of those that are actually just somewhat difficult to challenge. And historically, we've attempted to be, we've included those in this publication. We've attempted generally to be inclusive where there's doubt there. But the second thing the department does is we do produce estimates of revenue loss. We do work with state economists and with legislative revenue office staff to do that as well. And then finally, our role is we coordinate information flow among all the agencies that I mentioned that conduct these evaluations, as well as the DAS Chief Financial Office and the Governor's Office to facilitate the evaluations. So with that, Mr. Chair, we'd be happy to answer any additional questions or.
Thank you for that. We've all been distributed these books. They're also in your offices as well. Any further questions?
If you can turn the fire hose off.
Yeah. Okay. Yes, there's a lot to digest here, so. All right, let's move on to Chris and tax credits.
No questions with reservations.
No, I have reservations about any questions.
Incredible amount of stuff.
Morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Chris Allenite, Legislative Revenue Office. Just by way of a little bit of background, this report was. This is the first issue of this report. It's due to House Bill 2002 from 2013, and it focuses on the 18 tax credits that are scheduled to sunset at the end of this year. I would consider the report kind of a work in progress and is really a tool for policy committees to use this session as they grapple with what to do with the tax credits that are in their committees, whether they want to extend them or allow them to sunset or modify them in any way. The basic report, the report structure here in the table of contents, there are three sections of the report. The first one is background for tax expenditures, and that's basically a synopsis of the information you just heard. Section two is a tax credit review process. As you may recall, the sunsets on the tax credits were put in place in 2009 with House Bill 2067. They were divided into three groups, and every 2 years a different group would sunset so that all tax credits would receive some sort of review every 6 years. And in 2011 and 2013, leadership saw fit to create the Joint Committee on Tax Credits. And the process was a little bit different in each time, but roughly the policy committees reviewed these. They get referred to JTAX, and then JTAX handled kind of balancing a tax credit budget. And then the third section here is really kind of the meat of the report, if you will. And within each one of these, there are many papers on every tax credit. And to create some sort of organizational structure, they're divided into five different policy groups, if you will. You have healthcare, childcare, disability, business investment, and financial independence. And within each one of those, you have the individual tax credit. So just following up on the discussion you just had, this is just one way to organize them. It's not the only way to organize them. So I'm just going to bounce through a couple of pages here just to give you a flavor of the report and a bit of an orientation for it. And by way of background, on page 8 here, there are just a number of bills lifted here, kind of a chronology of legislation since 2007 as a kind of a roadmap as to how we got to here. In 2007, House Bill 3201 was a recent tax credit omnibus bill where a number of tax credits and expenditures were extended, and they were paid for by modifying or phasing down the personal exemption credit. And then in 2009, as I just mentioned, those were all the sunset dates placed on the tax credits. 2010, that's the time there was a lot of attention paid to Betsy, and House Bill 3680 focused a lot on the Betsy credit. And then in 2011 and 2013, House Bills 3672 and 3367 were subsequent tax credit omnibus bills. And then the other bill in 2013, House Bill 2002, created this report where the legislature was looking for a more in-depth analysis of what of the tax credits that were going to be sunsetting. And so just at a very high level, this summary table gets at the revenue impact numbers that the legislature will be dealing with. These 18 tax credits in 2013-15 had a revenue impact of about $144 million. And in 15-17, that current law revenue impact is down to $109 million. That's due to the sunsets. The cost of extending them all, a simple six-year extension, is about $64 million. So combining the current law and the sunset extension, the cost of those would be $170 million. So that top row there is the current law with the sunset, and that's why the number phases down over time, because you have carry forwards dying off, and then there are a couple of credits that are multiple year credits that that extend for a few years before they sunset. So that's kind of a tail, if you will, for a current law impact. And then the sunset extension basically doubles from 15-17 to 17-19, because in 15-17 it's generally a one-year impact, and then you get to a two-year impact. And the bottom line there is just a view of what the revenue impact would look like over time if they just weren't touched. So the two pieces kind of fit together to get a general trend of the cost of the tax credits.
Chris, why do they keep going up if they were allowed to sunset?
Well, the first...
the bottom row.
The bottom row is just assuming that they are allowed to sunset. It's the current law plus the sunset extension.
Oh, but okay, that's if they're extended.
If they're extended, yeah. Then that is the cost. We get a lot of questions about how the pieces fit together, how the current law fits together.
I see.
With
so
the
if we did nothing, that's the top row.
Correct. Yeah. If you did nothing, it's the top row. If you just extend them all, it's the bottom row.
And that's what's in the current forecast that we're going to see next week. It's assuming we're
correct.
Doing nothing. Yeah.
Right. And because that top row is what's in the current law revenue forecast, that's why there's a cost to extending them, because that adds to that revenue cost.
Question, Mr. Chair?
Senator Boquist?
I'm probably jumping ahead, but I'm just skimming through not yours, but the fine tax expenditure report. Unfortunately, spent three quarters of our time arguing about the definition of expenditure politically, so that's why we never get it done. But the two largest of those that I see in there are the qualified low-income community investment and the working family child care credit. Those are really the two largest ones.
Correct.
Neither of which are politically popular to eliminate. Just a statement of fact, not looking for a comment.
Yeah.
The co-chairs didn't give us enough money for one of them.
Well, kind of leading that into that, the table on page 11 here gets into the detail. They're still grouped together by these five policy areas, but this is a table that provides the cost under current law for each individual tax credit, and then the cost to extend the sunset date on those tax credits. So looking at the working family child care credit, for example, the cost in 13-15 was $43 million. In 15-17, it's $21 million, basically, because it sunsets in the middle of the biennium, so that's a one-year impact. And then that immediately falls to zero in 17-19 and 19-21. It's a refundable credit, so there is no carry forward. That when that sunsets, it's gone. And so when you look at the cost of extending it, again, no policy change, just simply extending it, it would cost $21 million in 15-17, and then you're back up to the $43, $44 million cost. So that's kind of the easiest conceptually in terms of it being a one-year impact or a two-year impact. The qualified low-income community investments, you can see even under current law, while it costs $9.3 million in 2013-15, it's expected to go up to $29 million this biennium, and $32 million in 2017-19, and then finally fall off in 2019-21. This is a tax credit that is a multiple-year tax credit. It's a I describe it as a seven-year tax credit, where the first 2 years there actually is no tax credit. And in the final 5 years, the tax credit is broken up into even pieces. Basically, the credit, there's a credit of 39% for investments made in certain areas. And in years one and two, zero is taken, and then years three through six, it's an 8% credit, and in the last year, it's a 7% credit. And so the sunset date has to do with the front end of that in terms of the investments being made. So no, as of the end of this year, no more investments can be made that would qualify for the tax credit. And in fact, right now, the tax credit is, the program is capped out because there is a program cap to that credit. And so that one, that still has, even under current law, a tail of a revenue cost, and actually increases over the next two biennium if nothing else is done. And the revenue impact on that, again, is zero for the next couple of years because of that structure. So if the sunset were extended, you still have the first 2 years of those investments being made that there is no cost to the tax credit. The cost would come back in subsequent biennia. So those are kind of two extremes of a simple version of a sunset with a working family child care credit, and about as complicated as it can be with respect to revenue impact on the other end.
Senator Edwards.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm trying not to trouble the committee with too many real basic level questions, but I do have a basic level question, given my first session sitting on this committee. So if I have understood in sessions prior, and I don't remember what year it was, but we started this process where we're basically sunsetting a third of the tax credits every biennium.
Yes.
Every biennium.
Every 2 years.
Started in 2009.
Yeah, okay. Started, yeah, that's what I thought, 2009. So, and those are statutory. So as we have been extending or reauthorizing tax credits, has it just been the discipline of this body to put new sunset dates on them, or have some been reauthorized without that sunset that would have it coming back up for, I mean, it's all statutory, correct? So I'm looking at Dr. Warner because.
Okay, well, Senator, yeah, the sunset process really does change the dynamics around the tax credits, because if no action is taken, they're going to go away.
Right.
So, which is a significant policy step, and particularly some of the cases you're looking at. So then if you decide that you would like the credit to be extended but in a modified form, then it may be in a form that would be less costly or have a smaller revenue impact than it would have if it was just continued in its current form. So that's one decision, and that does affect the dynamics around a decision or a bill for raising revenue.
Mm-hmm.
Because if there isn't a sunset and you reduce a credit, that's interpreted by council as a bill for raising revenue.
Mm-hmm.
So the sunset process changes that. And in terms of the budgeting process and the state forecast, the big change is that the forecast assumes they're just, it's current law, so they just assume that all these go away.
Right.
So then now, if you want them extended to the current form, you have to have some accommodation in the budget. And the governor in the tax expenditure report recommended that they be extended, all the income tax credits. So he built in $64 million to extend them all.
Mm-hmm.
But what the co-chairs have done after looking at the budget, they've built in $14 million to cover tax credits. So then that becomes kind of the budget constraint for the Joint Tax Committee to work within the co-chair's framework.
And then thank you for that that context. The other piece I'm wondering is since 2009, have there been tax credits that we have reauthorized without a sunset or a longer sunset than would have them on the schedule of automatic of sunset.
I think on that specific topic, or Chair Senator Edwards, on that specific topic of a longer sunset, there have been one or two that have gotten a longer sunset. Generally, they pertain to investment issues, where a long the argument is that a longer time horizon is needed. But in terms of the policy changes that we've seen in the two biennia, they have run the gamut. One tax credit, the sunset was moved forward to raise revenue, and then that money was redirected to a related spending program that had to do with diesel truck engines. And then some of them have been modified. They've been divided into different tax credits. One tax credit here, the rural medical providers tax credit, actually was on a different cycle and was scheduled to sunset last biennium. But the proponents, or however the discussions went, and I'm not privy to all those discussions, it was extended for just 2 years. And in the interim, there was a work group that got together to try and hash out some more details around it. So there has been a broad range of policy action taken on the different kinds of credits, and some have been allowed to sunset, and some have gotten a simple sunset extension that, okay, no change, just the 6 years.
Yeah, okay.
I think it's the preference, that the practice is to give them another 6 years.
Yeah.
For most of them.
Okay.
Thank you, Chair. If I could add,
yes.
On the in terms of the six-year extension, this was discussed quite a bit in 2009 and 2067. And, of course, you can't commit future legislatures to do anything. But the way that that bill was constructed is that if you have passed a new tax credit and it has no a sunset in it, or it doesn't say there isn't a sunset, then there's a fallback default is that it's 6 years.
Mm-hmm.
So, and that's in the statute. Of course, you could pass a credit and say that it has no sunset. Yeah. But if you don't say anything, then it's 6 years.
So if... So if you don't add the word notwithstanding, there is we have a separate statute that says they all have an automatic 6 year.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
And Senator Edwards, there's no such thing as a dumb question. As a former journalist, I don't know. There are dumb answers, no dumb questions.
Well, there are basic questions.
Go ahead, Chris.
Okay. So the next thing I just wanted to talk about is just to give a flavor of how these sections are set up. So we have a healthcare chapter, if you will.
I do have one question before I go forward, Mr.
Senator Boulkus.
Sure. I was just looking and made sure for Mr. Warner that, I mean, the one example was a qualified low-income community investments that you pointed out there. And I don't have your thick page because even on my iPad it's too small at my age to read it. But I was looking at the tax expenditure report, and interesting DORs back. You can beat them up. It's okay. The evaluation for that one that you just finished discussing as an example, it looked at me and it says evaluations by the Oregon Business Development Department. It's the largest one because I asked you that question. And it says there is insufficient data at this time for an analysis of this tax year's expenditures as the program has only had 1 year of data to report. And it's the largest one we have to make a decision on. I'm hopeful that Legislative Revenue Office in this other report has a little bit more guidance for us. I mean, the governor's report says, oh, we want to extend it for, I don't know, what is it, $21 million, but we don't have any data. I mean, that's one of the problems that I have with the expenditure report is it doesn't really give us decision makers much basis for making a decision. Is that pretty common you see these days in the expenditure report that comes out?
Chair Haas, Vice Chair Boulkus, different flavors of that. That's been one of the criticisms of the report, is that the evaluations are done by the state agencies, and a lot of stakeholders would like some other kind of evaluation. And so there's been a lot of grappling with, well, who would be the best entity to conduct that evaluation? And arguably, that's one of the things that led to the current report and to flush that out. And while So what I've tried to provide in this report is some sort of context for what questions need to be asked, and try to add and augment whatever data we have or can access on these programs. Again, add more information, provide more information to the policy committees as they're going through it. On that particular one, there is a little more data in the tax credit report, basically on the projects and the investments that were made by the entities eligible for that tax credit program. Doesn't necessarily go in and say this is good or bad, but provides more evaluation for members to come to their own conclusions about whether or not you think it's good or bad or should be changed in some way.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, so to that end, just relatively quickly, each chapter begins with there's a one or two page intro, and each of them has a table here. And a lot of the arguments behind creating the tax expenditure is this link between the indirect spending of tax expenditures and the direct spending of the Ways and Means process. So in the introduction to each chapter here, there is a sampling of direct spending programs that appear to be similar to different extents to the tax credits in that area. So for example, the first one, within the healthcare, I have a category of labeled rural and underserved, and the only tax credit in that area is the Rural Medical Providers Tax Credit. But there are also four direct spending programs that seem to be serve a similar function in terms of supporting medical providers or encouraging them to provide their services in rural areas. So you have, and they're basically loan repayments or loan forgiveness programs. And the only link here is the goal of the program. So those provide a direct financial incentive for doctors and nurses to provide services in certain areas, as does the rural medical tax credit. So it's really just to try and draw that distinction between the two a little bit closer in some sort of context to help policy committees think about, oh, well, if we have these direct spending programs trying to achieve this goal and for this reason, well, here's an indirect program. How do they fit together? Do they duplicate each other? And just ask those questions and think about those. And these are examples of direct spending programs that are trying to help move that process along a little bit more. Now within each, so you have a couple pages of intro, and then each tax credit has anywhere from one or two pages to a few pages of additional commentary. And within each tax expenditure here, each credit, we have a policy purpose, a description and revenue impact, a policy analysis, and then on other issues. And in many ways, this report can be viewed as an add-on or addendum to the tax expenditure report. Some of it will be naturally duplicative. The description, for example, that should be duplicative. The policy purpose, I tried to go a little bit more, because as I think you know, as in statute, there usually is not a policy purpose stated. So I went back to the implementing legislation, looked at the documentation that we had, and tried to graft some idea of what the proponents were arguing for when the different tax credits got put in place. And this is arguably one of the key provisions or the key things that we're trying to get out of this is in terms of evaluating any tax policy, it's extremely helpful to understand what that tax policy is supposed to achieve. So if we're able to get a very clear purpose statement or goal statement for the individual tax credits, that really defines the potential framework for evaluating that tax credit, because we're not really sure what the tax credit is supposed to do, it leaves a lot of ambiguities in terms of evaluating the tax credit. And this can be kind of a nuanced topic, because on the surface it can seem pretty straightforward, but if you dig a little bit deeper, it can be a bit of a nuanced question. And so that's the policy purpose, the description of the revenue impact. There's just a chart for each one of these that provides a historical revenue impact, generally from 05 through 2012. This tax credit is a little unusual in that it has a certification program. The Office of Rural Health certifies the tax credit. So that top green line looks at the number of certifications, and if all of those people claimed and used the full amount of the tax credit, that's the potential revenue impact or the potential cost of the program. So that's been over $10 million for the past few years. The red dashed line are what we get from tax returns, and we look at the actual amount that's claimed on the tax return. So there's already some attrition between that green line and the red line. the red dashed line. For some reason, the providers don't claim the tax credit. Maybe they were, at the end of the year, they were deemed ineligible, or they felt, they realized that they were ineligible, or I guess they could have forgotten about it, or they, their situation changed somehow from the time they got the certification to the end of the tax year. And the difference between the red dashed line and the blue line is the red line is simply the $5,000 credit that's claimed on the tax return. And the blue line is the amount that actually reduces tax liability. So if I'm eligible for this tax credit, and prior to claiming this tax credit, my liability is $4,500, I claim this credit. It's a non-refundable credit, so I only use $4,500 of that tax credit. So that's $500 that goes unused. And generally, those two numbers aren't that far apart, but it is one of the nooks and crannies of getting the full revenue impact and when that hits the revenue stream for the current law. So we do make that distinction. And on this particular one, in part because there was that work group, there are several pages of policy analysis that raise some questions that would be considered to evaluate the tax credit, and then some information from tax returns. I won't go through all of this. You can view that at your leisure, unless there are questions. Then the last piece is this other issue section. Part of House Bill 2002, it had a lot of requirements for the information to be included in this report. A couple of those items were administrative costs. So that information is actually kind of thin in the report, but where possible, this is where it gets included, the cost for administering the tax credit, whether that's the Department of Revenue or a certifying agency. So in this case, the Office of Rural Health. The other common question is what do other states do? So we had the help of two great interns this past fall who had the exciting job of searching the web and other states to find out what other tax credits that were similar to ours that other states had. And in the Appendix C, there are detailed tables of the states that we could find that had similar credits. What's included in the body of the report is this key characteristics. It's basically looking at those other states and trying to boil it down to something that's more digestible for policy work. Is these are the key characteristics. These are the policy levers that are used in other states for these kinds of tax credits. So again, just ideas to help move those discussions forward without getting buried in the detail of which states are offering which. But just these are the flavors of the policy tools used in other states. And at the end of each tax credit, there's this table that tries to summarize on advantages, disadvantages, and potential modifications. I did fill out these boxes for every tax credit. It was easier in some cases and more difficult in others, but I tried to at least provide one advantage and one disadvantage for the tax credits, for the given tax credit, and then some potential modifications. These aren't really LRO recommendations that these changes be made, but again, we often get questions, okay, well, what should we look at in terms of changing it? And so these are some suggestions to, again, help further that conversation about potential changes that could be made. And that structure is repetitive. It starts to repeat through. So it's really divided up that way. So each policy committee that has whichever tax credits, they can be pulled out, and they're kind of chapters, if you will, or standalone research briefs on those tax credits to provide some background information in whatever analysis we can provide in terms of potential policy framework questions. And that's it. There are some exceptions to that. The child care tax credits, for example, we have four child care tax credits where the policy is arguably very similar for the four of them, so there's only one policy analysis section. Rather than repeating largely the same language after each one, those are all described, and there's one policy analysis for that chapter. And then provide some historical context for those tax credits. But that's pretty much it for the flavor of the report. And hopefully that gives you a sense of what information's in there.
Thank you, very thorough. We have a lot to chew on here. And we'll be boning up on this when the tax credit joint committee fires up in
Mr. Chair, that's kind of up to you and the House Chair. Typically, we don't get these extension bills from the other committees until near the deadline, so I suspect it probably would be April or so where you'd start to have some bills collecting in Joint Tax Committee.
Yeah. Okay. Any questions, Chris?
This is the qualified low income community.
All right. That's all of our business for today and for this week. We'll come back on Monday and look at the amendments to our central assessment bills with hopes of fine-tuning that and getting it into one bill for passage perhaps later that week or the following week. So thank you. If there's no other business before us, we will. So thank you. If there's no other business before us, we will. Following week.